Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And Ken, this was the week that we saw that, well, you know, well into his fifth year as president, Barack Obama's getting a little frustrated.
Well, first of all, it was an amazingly historical moment because it is the 100th
day
of the second term.
Explain
to me, since when has that been a marker that people pay attention to?
Well, since we don't have another first term. I mean, we had to talk about the 100 days in the first term because that goes back to FDR, and that's a big deal, and the media got very excited about it, and people started talking about it when it was only about the 83rd day, and by the time we actually got to 100, it was really exciting. In fact, the president got up at a dinner 4 years ago and said, "Welcome to the one-week anniversary of my first 100 days in office," making fun of us in the media even then. This week, we come back with it again in the second term for the first time.
I've lost you at some point, but the bigger point, I think, is the fact that he held a press conference this week with no news, with no opening—well, I don't care about the opening statement part, but he called the press together to say what, exactly?
He called the press together. He hadn't had a news conference in 60 days or so.
Well, that's not new for him. In 2012, he went—
Months. Right. And many months. And it's only the third one he's had since he was reelected or since in the new year. And this was getting to be a little bit of an issue around the White House, why he didn't come out and meet the press. So they decided, well, fine, we'll come out and meet the press. That's not a very good idea.
It's not a good idea if you have nothing to say, if you have no pronouncements to make, if you have no policy changes. There have been, of course, some personnel changes this week, and we'll get to that in a second, but that was not the reason for the press conference.
No.
And everything seemed to be either, you know, I mean, Syria is pretty difficult, and Guantanamo is pretty difficult, and guns are pretty difficult, but, you know, something, there's a Congress out there, and they don't always listen to me, and I don't know what I could do.
It was a strange, shoulder-shrugging kind of a news conference in which not only did he not have an announcement or an opening statement, a big deal, he can just come right out and start taking questions if he wants, but only if he knows what he wants to say in answer to those questions. And don't tell me he doesn't know what the questions are. They were the most obvious things you could possibly imagine. Syria, the gun bill, the immigration bill.
Jason Collins.
The sequester. Jason Collins, which he actually did turn out
to be
prepared
for.
And, of course, he did have an answer for, but there was no theme, there was no point he was trying to make, and therefore his tendency to kind of shuffle off the blame onto the Republicans who won't cooperate with him, no duh, and of course they won't, and of course the Republicans are giving him all the trouble they possibly can. They see that as their job, and instead we hear things like this from the president.
You seem to suggest that somehow these folks over there have no responsibilities and that my job is to somehow get them to behave. That's their job. They are elected, members of Congress are elected, in order to do what's right for their constituencies and for the American people.
Could you imagine Lyndon Johnson having a press conference saying, well, you know, Congress is not doing its job, so until that happens, nothing's going to get done.
It's a little hard to even imagine LBJ having a news conference. He had some, but, you know, that was really not his milieu either. But he would not have ever acted as though he was at his wit's end with Congress in that particular way. And that's why he gets questions like this one, which was perhaps the most repeated question. Jonathan Carl from ABC News asked him if he still had the juice to be president, and he said this.
Maybe I should just pack up and go home. Golly. You know, I think it's a little, as Mark Twain said, you know, rumors of my demise may be a little exaggerated at this point.
I mean, first of all, the way he said it made me think that it may not be exaggerated. And of course, and I know your answer, but the first thing I thought of course, was Bill Clinton in April of 1995 talking about the relevance of his presidency.
Is the president still relevant to the process on Capitol Hill? That context was that the Republicans had just taken over the House and Senate.
Here's exactly how Clinton said it.
The Constitution gives me relevance. The power of our ideas gives me relevance. The record we have built up over the last 2 years and the things we're trying to do to implement it give it relevance. The president is relevant here, especially an activist president. And the fact that I am willing to work with the Republicans. The question is, are they willing to work with me? I have shown good faith.
And that was not a stellar moment in his presidency.
But remember, 12 hours later.
12 hours.
It was the bombing in Oklahoma City, the terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. And somehow the whole Bill Clinton presidency changed. He made a very forceful statement about what happened, the horror in Oklahoma City. And when the Republicans tried to shut down the government, Bill
later
Clinton
on that year.
Right, stood up to Newt Gingrich and the Republicans, again, did a masterful job. So he went from questioning relevance to an actual show of force, show what the president can do. It just seemed more self-pitying or more ridiculous this week listening to President Obama.
It was not a great moment, and I believe that the internal discussions within the White House that led up to this news conference were probably something along the lines of, gee, the president was so great at the White House Correspondents' Dinner the previous Saturday night, where he did a stand-up routine that most everybody agreed was funnier than Conan O'Brien, who was the paid entertainer for the evening.
Yeah.
Well, he was the paid entertainer. And, you know, Obama was good. He was on. He had some good lines.
I know Republicans are still sorting out what happened in 2012, but one thing they all agree on is they need to do a better job reaching out to minorities. And look, call me self-centered, but I can think of one minority they could start with. Hello?
And they were all feeling pretty good about the way that the president was posing himself against the media, and that this seemed like a good time, that he could make a few points with respect to his wars with the Republicans, and that he would come off well and humble and yet funny and yet in some respect or another the put-upon president who should have the support of the American people in his struggles against those evil Republicans.
And the evil journalists. But let's get away from the president's press conference or whatever you want to quote it. I want to talk for a second about Syria. The reason I want to talk about Syria is some Republicans like Lindsey Graham and John McCain and others like that seem to insist that, well, we haven't had enough incursions in the Middle East yet. Where's our next Afghanistan? Where's our next Iraq? But the choices are horrific. The thought of backing Assad, who obviously seems to be using chemical weapons against his own people, or this radical Islamist who may be, make up much of the opposition. I mean, how do you pick sides there?
Theoretically, according to the people who are in favor of taking a more robust role in Syria, using some sort of military intervention, not boots on the ground, not Americans, not Marines, not U.S. service people, but in some sense or another providing weapons to the people we find least objectionable in this multi-sided civil war.
Whoever that is.
That's right. Well, they claim there is someone. They claim that there are people we could funnel weapons to that would be, I suppose, the most responsible parties. Well, let's say the least anti-U.S. Wow. among them, and that this would be a good way to resolve the conflict in the best way possible, given that there are no good outs.
But here's the thing that bugs me the most is that why lay down this marker? Why lay down and say, okay, there's a red line that Assad shouldn't cross? Now, obviously, Assad has never been on the Washington, D.C. metro. I don't know why he would be on the red line to begin with. That's a very, very funny joke that nobody will get.
But it's killer.
Yes.
As
it should be. But more importantly, why call that bluff? Because what happens when something changes? Then what do you do?
Yeah. And I think that... why make that bluff if someone's obviously prepared to call it?
See, part of my frustration is that no, we should not rush into, we should not risk more American lives in a civil war that you don't know whose side you're backing, who are the good guys and the bad guys, if there are good guys at all. That, combined with the press conference on Tuesday, just didn't seem to me a good quality of leadership.
Well, and it also dovetails with several other issues where the president looks weak. For example, the Guantanamo base, where we still have a number of detainees left over from the war on terror in the previous decade, the previous administration. The president wanted to close Guantanamo. He tried to close Guantanamo.
Did he?
Congress basically said, you can't bring those guys here. You either have to get them back to their countries, and by the way, don't get them back to their countries if it means they're going to be freed and back in the terrorism business.
Which probably would happen.
Which could easily happen in a lot of those countries. And so he had few options other than to keep it open and try to get these people offloaded onto other countries, which they have tried to do, but which hasn't been entirely successful. There's still more than 100 people there. Now, most of them are on a hunger strike. It's turning into another international embarrassment for the United States. And the president doesn't look good on that particular issue, even if he has tried to do what he said he was going to do. Ditto with guns.
And we're still not sure what's going on with the gun measure. There's still some talk about Pat Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania, Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, two pro-gun lawmakers who clearly were disappointed that, their background check bill, which seemed to be a minimum for some gun control proponents, failed. But they say they're going to bring it back, and there's obviously we've seen a lot of pressure on lawmakers. The big news of the week seemed to be going against Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire. Of course, she is not up for re-election until 2016, but she's the only member of the Senate, I guess, and the whole eastern seaboard north of Virginia to vote against the background check. And she's getting a tremendous amount of heat. Telegrams, you saw what happened at town hall meetings. There's now a new group called Stop NRAYotte. I mean, they're basically combining
Kelly and
So
and her poll numbers have reached new lows.
They have. Now, of course, there is some talk about some kind of other compromise, maybe other kind of language, but they're trying to woo some of these moderate, so-called moderate Republicans, if they bring this bill back to see if there can be some momentum.
And I do believe that there is still some chance of that. I mean, the smart money is that once a bill's been on the floor of the Senate and it's been pulled, it's dead. And that's historically true.
Well, remember the Brady Bill. The Brady Bill failed several times before it passed.
So. That's true. And guns can be a special issue. And let's remember that there were 55 votes at one point in the Senate for this particular approach to a gun bill. And that's not negligible, and all you really need is one or two more, and you could probably pull over one or two of those Democrats who also joined the opposition. So look, we got 90% of the Democrats on one side, 90% of the Republicans on the other side, but there's still enough wiggle room in there that a bill could happen. And it's interesting to see that Pat Toomey, whom we mentioned as one of the co-sponsors, is seeing the best poll numbers he's seen in a very long time. And that Joe Manchin doesn't seem to have suffered at all for having done this in West Virginia. The people there seem to like it. And down in Arizona, where Jeff Flake bailed out on the bill because he was trying to represent what Arizonans by and large seem to believe on guns.
Or once upon a time.
Or what he believed they thought on the Second Amendment.
New Hampshire's a pro-gun state too.
Well, exactly. Most of these states we're talking about. Pennsylvania's a big pro-gun state outside of the two metropolitan areas. So this is a place where the ball is taking kind of a funny bounce. And Jeff Flake has seen his polls tank since this kind of high-profile change of mind. He was a great friend of Gabby Giffords, as we've observed, and yet, despite that personal relationship, he voted against the universal background checks for gun purchases.
Before we leave the administration completely, there are some personnel announcements this week. First of all, the president on Thursday announced that Penny Pritzker will be the new Secretary of Commerce. She's worth, I think, $1.85 billion. Dollars,
yeah, give or take several, you know,
which is
tens
more,
of millions,
which is more than I make in like a decade. I mean, really, if you include the podcast and the column Political Junkie, which you could read on npr.org/junkie.
Hold on just a second. I'm writing that down. I'm writing that down. Yes, Penny Pritzker, who is an heiress. I think we can still use the term heiress of the Hyatt Hotel fortune, which was co-founded by her father. The Pritzker family's name is all over Chicago, like the DuPont family name is all over Delaware. And she was an early and heavy backer of the ambitions of one young Barack Obama. Yeah. So it's kind of amazing to me that we're here in the fifth year of this presidency, and she is just now getting into the cabinet, just now getting her reward. I mean, she was never given an ambassadorship or anything. My guess is he's always been a little bit embarrassed by the sheer wealth and some of the business connections that the Pritzker family has had, including to a bank that went under in 2003.
Apparently, she has a difficult relationship with unions, which the Democratic base may not be so happy with. There's also two other appointments this week, both African-American men from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Interestingly enough.
Exactly. Anthony Fox, who is the mayor, who announced he would not run for a third term this year, was announced this week as the transportation secretary. He's long been a champion of public transit, so he will be replacing Ray LaHood, who's not African-American, but he starred in the movie Boys in LaHood, which I thought was a very important thing.
And also provided some diversity in the cabinet as a Republican.
That's exactly true.
And as a guy whose last name began with La.
Well, I never thought of it that way for many reasons. Also, Congressman Mel Watt has been nominated to head up the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
What?
I said Mel Watt, the congressman from North Carolina, will head up the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
Mel?
But anyway, there's talk about a Republican filibuster. They may not allow. I think Obama has several times tried to fill this position, and Mel Watt may face a tough going in the Senate. Bob Corker of Tennessee has already said this is an objectionable nomination, so we'll see if Mel Watt ultimately does win confirmation.
And rounding out the cabinet, which is now complete, assuming that these people get confirmed, which, as you point out, is somewhat problematic, but most of them are probably going to sail through, Michael Froman will be the new U.S. Trade Representative. He's been an economic advisor to the president in the White House.
Now, the campaign news of the week, two events. First of all, there was a big debate in South Carolina for the 1st District. There was also a primary on Tuesday to fill the Senate seat now held by Mo Cowan.
Yes, everyone knows about Mo Cowan.
Yeah, yeah. I love his two brothers, Curly and Larry, but of course, Mo Cowan was the temporary appointee for John Kerry. Now, in the Democratic primary, as expected, Ed Markey, who's been in Congress since 1977.
This is an amazing number, 1977.
No member of Congress, no person in American history has ever been in the House that long and then went on to win election to the Senate. Ed Markey would be breaking a record, but it still looks like he will do that. First of all, he did win the primary.
Almost 60%.
Yeah, big over Stephen Lynch. Now, Stephen Lynch, of course, voted against Obamacare. He votes against abortion rights.
But there are a lot of conservative Democrats in that huge Massachusetts
mass. And he's very pro-union. He's very pro-union. He tried to
use... And he's pro-life.
He is pro-life.
And a lot of Massachusetts people are pro-life. And that's one of the reasons they elect, you know, Republican governors. And some conservative
Democrats. Governors were kind of pro-choice. I mean, Mitt Romney back then was pro-choice.
Multiple choice.
Exactly. But the Republican nominee is an interesting guy, Gabriel Gomez.
He is a former Navy SEAL. And in some ways, he might galvanize the kind of support, the kind of moderate to conservative Massachusetts voter, independent voter, who voted for Scott Brown. He's got a shot.
There's more to the story. He's a Harvard business graduate. His parents are from Columbia. I mean, it's a good, feel-good story. At least the Republicans feel that way. And, of course, they could point to Ed Markey as a career politician. But ultimately, I think the Democratic nature of the state, I mean, Scott Brown was an aberration. Comparing it to Scott Brown perhaps is a little bit of a stretch. The issues are different. The anger against the Democrats certainly is not the same. And
Tea Party energy that was running even in Massachusetts at that time in 2009.
And Ed Markey is a better. I mean, even though Ed Markey hasn't been challenged in a long, long time, I mean, he wins overwhelmingly in the seat. He is a much better candidate than Martha Coakley. So I think the Democrats hold the seat in the June special election. But we do have another special election coming up next Tuesday in South Carolina's 1st congressional district. Mark Sanford, of course, against Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
And they had their one debate, and she raised the issue of the governor's infidelity when he was governor. And this is the way she went about doing that.
During the time when we're having all this fiscal spending, fiscal cutting, and back to the days where everybody had a furlough in the state, everybody was losing their jobs, and we were pulling our belts in, when we talk about fiscal spending and we talk about protecting the taxpayers, it doesn't mean you take that money we saved and leave the country for a personal purpose.
She went there, Governor Sanford.
I couldn't hear what she said.
Governor Sanford, when you were in Congress, you voted for the Defense of Marriage Act and to impeach President Clinton for an extramarital affair. Would you vote those ways again?
Well, I would reverse the question to you. And I would say this. Do you think that President Clinton should be condemned for the rest of his life based on a mistake that he made in his life?
I mean, ultimately, this is all about Mark Sanford. We've said this for weeks. Elizabeth Colbert Bush can talk about jobs, the economy, the port of Charleston, you know, none of this matters. Now, she also has a ton of money, perhaps $1 million coming in from Nancy Pelosi and associated Democratic PACs.
Which is being used against her, of course.
Well, of course, in a conservative district. But you know something? Ultimately, the big problem seems to be this. First of all, he's running against a female candidate, Elizabeth Colbert Bush. He's walking around with a cardboard cutout of a female former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. And of course, all the voters are thinking about what he did to his ex-wife, Jenny Sanford. The question is, if Elizabeth Colbert Bush is going to win the election, it's going to be the votes of Republican women, I suspect, that are either going to stay home or just come out and vote for her.
That's right. His great fear really has to be that Republicans would just as soon have him out of the picture. And they're willing to put up with a year and a half of a Democrat in the seat and come back and perhaps vote for Jenny Sanford in November of 2014 and take it back for the Republican Party. That's a pretty good prospect for the Republicans who just don't care for Mark Sanford and don't particularly want the symbolic impression on the rest of the country and on the Congress of sending Mark Sanford back to Washington.
True, but some Republicans are coming home, coming back home. Nikki Haley this week held up the governor of South Carolina, who has problems with it in her own right, but Nikki Haley held a press conference for Mark Sanford. Ron Paul and Rand Paul both have endorsed Mark Sanford. And Tim Scott, the previous incumbent in the 1st Congressional District, who was appointed to the U.S. Senate, that's how this district became open to begin with. Tim Scott is also strongly backing Mark Sanford. So I agree with you. I think there are a lot of Republicans who wish Mark Sanford would go away, but there are other Republicans saying, we want this guy to win. We want to keep the seat. And ultimately, it doesn't matter. I mean, the Republicans still have a sizable lead in the House. It's not like a Senate seat where the numbers are so closely watched. But the last poll I saw was a PPP Democratic-leaning poll that had Colbert Bush up by 8 or 9 points. I don't know what the effect the debate has. I don't know if Republicans are going to come back to the fold, but it's going to be something to watch on Tuesday.
All a question of turnout, and the poll cannot really measure turnout no matter what you say. You cannot determine when you're polling whether or not you're really finding that tiny little sweet spot of people who are going to turn out for this event next week in South Carolina.
You know, the only poll that counts is on Election Day.
And that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Sharish Date.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Don't look at me, I'll turn your whole world upside down. Get rowdy, loud.